A lot of people, you probably heard him talk to me. You heard about him before he died?
Yeah.
He was very good at what he did. I used to say that he could talk to beginners and make them understand, while at the same time people who understood everything thought, this is interesting. And he could talk to both levels at the same time. And I kind of wish I could do that, so I'm not even going to try. What I'm going to tell you about is some of the early history of Commodore, because I was actually part of that. I actually owned one of the first Commodore PET that was made for public sale. I got it actually, the guy I worked for at the time helped, and he bought it directly from Commodore. So I had one before it actually hit most of the stores. So I was in it early. But I'm going to start a little sooner than that, and I want to tell you how I got into computers and how I liked what you buying the PET. That was actually about 2 years earlier, and I was still in high school at the time, and I happened to stumble across the room in which they had the school computer. And at the time, the Peel Board of Education had a single Wang computer, I forget the model, but it shared amongst the various high schools in Peel. And we had it at our school for a little while in December and January of 1976. This computer could be programmed in BASIC, and pretty much probably do what a Commodore PET could do. But since it only had one keyboard and one screen, you couldn't let the kids sit in front of it and program their programs in on the keyboard. So it also had a card reader. If anybody's seen optical and punch cards, we had tons of these optical mark cards, and you used to sit there and tick off with a pencil each character you wanted to enter into your program, and then they feed them into the little hopper, and it would and read it all in, and then you test your program out, and then you get off, and the next guy did. So it wasn't a very interactive kind of an experience, but it fascinated me what potentially I could do with this machine. And even though I didn't take any of the courses, I came in after school, and I played around with it whenever I could until they finally kicked me out. But I was really sort of hooked on the whole idea of programming just from that little experience. So I couldn't really... You know, there weren't a lot of choices for home computers back in those days. There were some for the really hardcore hardware types. You know, if you really wanted to screw around with home computers, you had to build yourself. So I went another route. I got interested in high-end programmable calculators. And the first one I bought was a Texas Instruments SR56. Not a particularly great piece of hardware, but it satisfied me for a little while. And then, about in early 1977, Philip Haver came out with the HP 67 for the second generation of their HP 65. It had a magnetic card reader in it. You got these little tiny cards, you put them in one side, and the little motor would take it right the way through. It would read either programs or data that you could store on these cards, saving me having to type in my program every time I wanted to run it. So this is how you used to have to do it. You wanted to run a program on your programmable calculator, you turned it on, you cleared the memory, and you entered the program. When you were finished, you turned it off, and that was it, your program was gone, until next time you entered a new one. So life was kind of tough doing programming that way, but the Hewlett-Packard calculator with the card reader was kind of a move toward computers in a sense, because I could now store written programs on cards, and any time I wanted to run them, I just zipped the card through and it loaded it. Just like a miniature old tape drive. But anyway, during 1977, I was out of high school, and I was working on running a computer at a place called Dymaster Tool in Mississauga, and they had a machine called a Hewlett-Packard HP 9830. It's kind of a cross between a calculator and a computer in that it was a full computer, it ran BASIC, and it had all sorts of ports on it, working on peripherals, but it had a single-line display. It primarily meant to be used with the printer that was on top of it. It was used at the company to produce punch tape, like small strips of tape with paper with a little hole in it, to run a numerical control for a thing called an EDM, electro discharge machine. It uses a wire that has electric charge in it, and it literally slowly cuts big sheets of metal, like metal this thick. You make dies out of them that way. But anyway, it was my job to work with that, and I also rewrote the entire program for producing those tapes, because the one that came with it was kind of crappy. So I got a lot of experience writing software, at least in BASIC anyway, on this particular computer. And it was around that time, in late 1977, that I went to one of the production shows. I don't think it's still around. It's called the Toronto Plant Engineering and Manufacturing. and it was at the International Center, and one of the people there showing off stuff was Connor, and they had their prototype of their pet, and they were showing it off at the show, and I saw it, and I thought, I've got to get me one of those. Even at the originally projected price of $900, and it eventually went up to $1,200, I still had to have one. So with a little help from the guy who ran Dynamaster, he, like I said, he actually ordered one directly from Commodore, and I got mine as quickly as I could, which was about May of 78. And from the moment I got it, I kind of forgot to eat and do things like that, because my whole spare time was spent sitting in front of this computer. You know, I forget to go to the washroom, I forget to eat, I kind of forget to go to bed. And it fascinated me. So I wrote everything I could think of. First things I did, I took anything I'd written on my programmable calculators and I wrote pet versions of them. And then I would write things that I couldn't write in my calculator, because I actually had a fairly big display. I mean, okay, the Commodore PET, 40 columns wide by, what was it, 25 high? That's not very much, but compared to a calculator with a little tiny one-line display where we display numbers, it was a big step up. At any rate, during that first year that I, or first few months that I had the PET, Dynamaster bought a word processing machine, also made by Wang, funny enough they come in the picture again. It was a Wang dedicated word processing machine, probably very, very simple by today's standards, but I played with it quite a bit when I had spare time, and I thought to myself, I should be able to make my PET do this. So I went home and I started thinking about how to do it, and I thought, okay, we'll write it in BASIC, you know, because that's what Commodore had on the machine. So I started writing it, but there was a big problem. First of all, BASIC is very hungry for memory. It uses up a lot and does very little. Plus, there was, I don't know if any of you have used the old machines, you know, they had that real big problem with garbage collection, because the strings were allocated dynamically, and then when you used up the memory, they'd have to clear it all up. And this actually took quite a while to happen, and it could take seconds for a garbage collection to occur. And because of the intensive use of strings within a word processing program, these garbage collections were happening every few minutes while you were sitting there trying to use it. And this was unacceptable. You couldn't use a word processor that paused for a few seconds every few minutes. So I thought, okay, there has to be another way to write the same thing. And this is where I got interested in the idea of writing in machine language. That's where you actually program the processor at its level, rather than using a higher level language like BASIC. Because now I'd be able to do what I wanted to do, and there'd be no problem with garbage collection. It would be faster, and it would be more efficient. And efficient is very important. You know, the original Commodore PET had 8K memory total. And apparently a fair bit of that was used up by the system. So you had about 7,100 and some odd bytes free. And I had to write both the program in that space and have enough left over to store a document that was worthy of actually working on. I mean, I think you can realize that 4K doesn't really constitute a particularly big document. I mean, you know, 2 or 3 pages if you're lucky, depending on what you're writing. But this was the limitations that I was working under, but it was much more than I ever could have done before before the PET came along. So the first problem I had was, how do you write a machine language program? There were no assemblers. There was no way to put together a machine language program. I had to what's known as hand assemble. What this means is you learn the operational codes for the processor, and you sit down and on paper, you write out the code you're going to have execute. And then you work out the hexadecimal values for each one of the codes and the values associated with it. And then using this little program called a machine language monitor, which was really nothing more than a simple editor to view and change bytes in memory, you literally typed in every single code. And then you saved it on tape. And this is how you program in machine language. It was tedious, and if anything went wrong, it really kind of had to work everything out again, because all of the jumps changed location if you have had to move things around. So it was a tedious thing. So I thought, okay, I'm going to make my life a little bit easier here if I'm going to continue doing this. And I wrote my own assembler, a very simple one. And I even used the early versions of my text editor, the early forerunners of WordPro, as the editor for my assembler. And I didn't try to make it saleable or anything. I just wanted to make it a tool that I could use to make my life easy so I could move on and get away from some of the tedium of having to do it by hand. Now, as far as WordPros start, I hadn't really intended to market it or try to make anything big out of it. As I said, my real initial task was just to make a text editor that worked kind of like the Wang word processor I knew from where I was working at the time. And given the limited amount of space, I kind of figured that editing was about as much as I was really going to try and do. But I did get some interest from people because around late 1978, I heard that there were stores in the downtown Toronto area that sold pets, and people hung around them during the weekends. So for 6 or 7 consecutive Saturdays in a row, this is before I went to the car, I took the subway downtown, and I would hang out at these pets. There was one at, I can't even remember the name of them, they were at, they were located in the shopping concourse below the Hudson's Bay Center, right between the two exits from the subway. If you're familiar with that stop, you know there's the doors here and the doors here, and there's a little kiosk inside store stuck right in the middle. Well, that used to be a little calculator store, and they sold a commoner pet. So that was one place that people would come and hang around. The Hudson's Bay store itself, they had one. The Eaton store down at the Eaton Center had one. And there was this gadget store not too far from Bay and Bloor called Marketron, who also sold pets. So these are the ones I would cycle between. And I would inevitably meet mostly kids coming there with their tapes of whatever games or programs they collected from their friends or somebody else. And we trade programs. So this is how I got a lot of some of the early programs I got for the machine. But I also showed off my text editor, thinking that, you know, I'll show some things I've been doing. And a number of people actually said, you know, this has some potential, I'd buy a copy of this, but you got to get it to print. So I said, well, okay, I hadn't really thought of that. So that's not really what I don't own a printer. So anyway, so I thought, okay, I'll have to write what I refer to as a text format. And because of the memory restrictions, I wrote it as a separate application, literally a separate program you have to load in. You got an editor and a formatter whose job it was to format the text and send it to the printer. Because again, there was the huge memory restrictions with barely 3K of actual usable space for the program. There wasn't very much I could write. So anyway, so I started work on this formatter actually without even owning a printer. I actually had it just to sort of do it to the screen. I knew how to access printers through the Commodore PET, but without having one, I could only guess it would work. I got a chance to try it out at a few of the stores when I visited them later on and showed them off. Another place that I actually went that wasn't in the downtown area was this place called Communication Specialists, who eventually became, shortened their name, and became ComSpec, who were quite big players in Commodore days back in the 70s and the 80s. They were located on Wilson Avenue, out near the Alamo. Originally, they were quite close to the Alamo, but they moved a little further to the east. I forget what street that was at. Angle?
That was the one
where
they offered, but yeah, 633 Wilson.
Yeah. Anyway, so these were the places where pets were, and this is the place where it was worthy to hang around to get my stuff seen and to see what other people had. But I guess probably one of the biggest, the program that everybody wanted to get their hands on back in those days, in the early days of the PET, was Microchess. Because this was an incredible piece of programming work, really, and, well, certainly from my perspective. It's a program that would run on that simple little 8K PET that could play chess. And this was the early days of chess on computers, at least for most people. And it was a brilliant bit of work. It was written by, I don't remember his name,
Peter Jennings,
who was also from Toronto. Now that brings up that point that was made about Toronto being kind of this hub of activity. There were so many of the big stuff that was written for the Commodore machine in the early days was written by people here in Toronto, no matter how big it got to be known. For example, WordPro and my biggest competition, Paperclip. Anybody remember that? That was written by Steve Douglas, yeah. And he was here, he lived in Toronto as well. Of course, Commodore was pretty much a Toronto company. They operated mostly out of here. I know that all the construction and the computer stuff was done out of California, but I think that was, I don't know the history of Commodore per se, but I think that was just a decision on their part, but I believe that they were based in Toronto. At any rate, so a lot of the big names in programming in the early days seemed to come from Toronto, and that was backed up by the level of interest in the Commodore PET in Toronto as well. I'm sure you've probably heard the PCOG at one time had 20,000 members. That was at its peak time. Now, arguably, that may have been a mistake. Do you remember who it was who pushed for that? Was it Tony, what was his name, Bennett?
Chris
Bennett. Chris Bennett. Wasn't he the one who really pushed for the a lot of members?
Yeah, he was sort of
one of the few. Yeah, but maybe it wasn't him, but one of the people involved in the board of directors seemed to think that it would be a really cool idea if we got everybody in the world to join. So they kind of went after that. But in the early days, the Commodore group started as a small little get-together at a guy named Lyman Duggan. And you may have heard his name. He ran this little PET club out of the basement of his condominium over by Shepherd and Highway 404. And the early meetings, I didn't get to go to some of the really first ones because I didn't have a car yet. It was kind of hard to get all the way over to Shepherd and the 404 from Mississauga. But I did get a car at the end of 1978, so I attended the first meeting in January of 1979. And by then, there were actually more people at that meeting than there are right now. So it had become quite popular quite quickly. And everybody was there to find out what they could do with their computers because everybody wanted to know, you know, because I think in the beginning, you didn't buy a Commodore PET unless you were really interested in doing something with it. Now, while I don't think many people were cut out to be programmers, I think that they had the desire to at least find out what they could make their machine do. And so they would come to the club meetings to find out what they could learn, both from programmers and from people who had done stuff with their computers so they could find out what they could do with theirs. So it was a different kind of atmosphere back in those days. It really was only one type of person, and that was the enthusiast, you know, the person who just wanted to get right in there and do whatever they could with this brand new toy they bought. That did change quite quickly. Certainly by the time we hit 20,000 mark, I think only a small percentage of the people who actually came to the club came to it because they really wanted to do anything with their computers as opposed to simply get their hands on free software. I'm pretty certain most of them joined the club so they could get free software, but certainly the swap meets were very popular. They were well attended. So people, I mean, I don't blame them. I mean, that's one of the things you do if you get a new machine you want to do stuff with. The easiest way is to go get software. I suppose it was all pirating. It's kind of equivalent to sitting on your internet today and grabbing whatever software you can get off of that. I don't think anybody sort of seriously looked at it like that. I mean, the whole concept of pirating hadn't even really surfaced in the early days because I don't think anybody really had a concept of what that was. Certainly, if you were selling software and trying to make money on it, you did realize that people taking free copies was a big problem. And I want to talk about the early attempts to protect software. I don't know if any of you have ever experienced it. I don't know how many of you have actually go back far enough to have ever experienced this, but there was all sorts of weird ideas trying to protect programs from being copied. Usually they involve things you had to plug into your computer. We called them dongles. They would plug into one of the various ports on the computer, and if you didn't have one of these little hardware devices, the program would refuse to run. And it was a good idea to a point, but if the dongle failed to work, or there was a problem with it, or the port wasn't working right, then your program wouldn't run, and it came to be known that most of these copy protection schemes hurt the legitimate users more than they hurt the pirates. So eventually we tried to find other ways to protect software from copying, and I think mostly the hardware protection schemes were abandoned by and large, because they really were kind of, they didn't work a lot of times. But it was certainly a way to protect software from being stolen. But most of the software that people really wanted anyway was games. But there was some interest in things like word processing and certainly the early spreadsheets. Everybody remembers some of the early ones. VisiCalc was the original, yeah. And that was available for the Commodore machines. And it was an amazing bit of software because nobody had ever thought about working with data that way before. Nowadays, spreadsheets are just, you know, you haven't played with spreadsheets. But in those days, you could do almost anything you wanted with a computer, and everybody would think it was a great idea. You know, word processing, VisiCalc, anything you could make the computer do, any games you could manage to play with them, that was fine. I remember one of the early games that attempted to use the crude graphics that was available through the character set of the PET, was one that tried to simulate shooting at TIE fighters. Yeah, the whole Star Wars idea, because of course, as you know, Star Wars came out in 1977, just before the Commodore PET came out. So there was a big interest in things like Star Wars and these sort of things based on Star Wars at that time. So there were plenty of that kind of thing. But the graphics, if you could call it that, in the original Commodore PET was really limited to what we call special characters, you know, like characters with higher than 127 in the ASCII set. And they would make up various boxes, and some of them were 45-degree angles. And if you were imaginative enough, and you combine these characters in such a way to draw out very crude shapes, and that was pretty much what graphics was all about in early Commodore machines. It was the 64 and the VIC when they came along that changed all that by providing actual raster graphics where you could actually turn on pixels and change their colors. That was not possible in the Commodore PET, which wasn't even color. It was monochrome. In the early ones, it was white. Then they were green. There are various color schemes, but pretty much black and some other color. Right? And like I said, you didn't have direct access to pixels. So you couldn't say turn on this pixel, this pixel, this pixel. You could only address the screen by its character. The 24, the 40 by 25 characters. So the little symbols that Commodore made up in the character set were very useful for drawing crude graphics. And it was actually kind of, you know, cool what you could do to make stuff look a little classier than just a bunch of characters on the screen, which most so-called serious software was. It really is just a bunch of characters. But I wrote programs like this one I wrote called Reverse. Do you know how you play that? For those who don't know, Reverse is a simple game. Basically, you take a string of numbers, and it says numbers 1 to 9, and all jumbled up. And you have to get them into order, and the way you do it is you pick a spot in the list, and then all of those numbers are reversed up to that spot. So you have to work it out so that you eventually get them in order in the least number of slots possible. In retrospect, it's a stupidly simple game, but it just begs to be programmed. So I wrote a program that built a nice little box on the screen, put the numbers in. When you told them where to reverse, the little bar would go across and change them all and go back. It looks like it was reversing them. And this was great fun. As for card games, the Commodore were at least bright enough to include, as part of their character set, the four card suits. There was a spade symbol, a club symbol, and a diamond symbol, and a heart symbol. And even though you couldn't show them in color, you could at least draw cards. And put the little symbols in, you know, eight of hearts, whatever. And so writing games that included cards was actually quite doable. You could use the symbols to draw a box. You could then, you know, say it was an eight of hearts, you'd say an eight heart, then put eight hearts in the middle of it. And it would kind of look like a card. So it was at least doable. So card games, they were quite popular too, because they could be done using the limited graphics that were available. And I wrote a one that would play blackjack, things like that. You know, I would sit there and spend a lot of time writing these things, even though I had no intention of doing anything with them commercially. I just wanted to program the silly thing, and that's all that really interested me was programming. And it's funny because until the Commodore PET came along, I was kind of headed toward becoming an electrical engineer. But the moment I saw programming, I totally lost interest in it. That's all I've done ever since, programming. So, it's kind of amazing how, as an important change in our society that the Commodore PET represented for people like me, maybe less so for the general public. Because I always used to joke that the only thing they tried to sell these computers to the general public for was to store recipes. And I kind of made that into my sort of theme for any time I see somebody trying to push a technology for something utterly stupid. You know, like they're just trying to come up with a reason to get you to buy it. I go, look, that's like storing, recipes. It was the killer app that no one ever used. Let me hear, anybody ever store recipes on a computer, really? I don't think so. But every ad and everything you ever saw, you think that was what they would have done to do. It was the thing they used to push them out the door, to get people to buy them. And, I don't think that there was very much imagination amongst the advertising people, but it sold the product. So. I think the reason that recipes were chosen as an application for the computer is because anybody who worked with recipes knew that if you wanted to scale a recipe to a different size, you had to do all the math to work out all the different ingredients. Whereas the computer could pump all that out for you. If the recipe you entered would produce 12 cupcakes, if you only wanted to make 5, then you could have it spit out the exact ingredients needed to make 5. Now this was the reason why recipes were targeted as being something cool your home computer could do for you. Obviously they didn't think of a lot else because when Commodore released the PET, there were no peripherals. None whatsoever. The PET was sold as standalone exactly as it was. They hadn't included that cassette tape player in it. We wouldn't even have a way to store and load programs. Because there were no peripherals. First peripheral they made was a secondary cassette unit. They had a port at the back of the PET for a second cassette. Now, you want to know how slow these cassettes were? I mean, it makes 300 baud modems seem fast. These things were so slow, I don't remember the exact baud rate, it was something well below 100. And it literally, to load in a 4K program could take 3 minutes. Anybody here think you're waiting 3 minutes to load a program so tiny that you can't even imagine how small it is? So imagine trying to load in a megabyte of stuff from something as slow as that tape. And as for reliability, forget it. But anyway, but as the PET got bigger, you know, it got the, you know, 16K, 32K, 64K. These numbers were literally impossible to store on tape. I mean, obviously they had to move to something else, and they did. But I used to store all my stuff on tape, but the problem was, no matter how good a tape you bought, the reliability of playing it back and getting it to read properly was really low. You had to make multiple copies if you intended to keep anything seriously. Because that's how poor it was. I mean, even the original floppies weren't much better. But at least they were faster. So Commodore came out with... the thing is, if you didn't buy equipment back then, it will boggle your mind how much they charged for this stuff. The 8250, which was the double-sided 5 1/4 inch floppy in a dual drive, you know how much they wanted for it? Yeah, $2,500. And you didn't flinch at paying that kind of money to buy it. I mean, this is for something you can now buy, the same capabilities from a store for like $10. But
the 8252,
that's the same money. Oh, yeah. The computer itself was
expensive. Yeah. I bought the pair and it was $5,000.
Yeah. I know. That's a lot of it. And if you scale that up to today's money, like this is $5,000 in the early 1980s. Scale it up to today, you're looking at about $10,000 to buy a PET and a couple of floppy drives.
To buy a car for $2,500.
Yeah. So you can see how much money we're talking about. So it was a lot of money for a lot of nothing, but it's only nothing compared to today. Back then, it was a lot of something because you couldn't get your hands on computers unless you worked at a company that had one or you worked at a university where they had one. You know, computers up to that point were worth millions. And you couldn't get your hands on them, and that was that. Programmable calculators were the closest thing to computers that the general public had, really, until Commodore created the PET. Now, I don't want to play down the fact that there were computers before the Commodore PET, but like I said, these were more targeted, hardware-oriented people who were willing to build their own equipment. They weren't turnkey systems. You really had to be willing to do everything from the ground up. Commodore, their equipment wasn't exactly, capable compared to today. It had things that other computers hadn't had all in one package. It had the monitor. It had a keyboard. It had a tape to store stuff on. It had ports that you could connect future printers to. And but certainly one of the most imaginative things anybody did with the port on the computer, on the early PET, was it had what it was called It was the accessory port. Basically, it was just 8 bits that you could turn on or off, and you could physically control things through it. And what somebody thought was, if we took a cascading values of resistors and put them onto each of those pins, then by simply turning on various ones of these pins, we can get a cascading level of voltage at the other side of those resistors. Right? Like the pin at this end might have a big, say, I forget what the values were, I'll just make them say 100K, the next one 50K, and 25K, and so on. Then each one produced a slightly different voltage. And they actually managed to create a very crude but workable digital to analog converter by just using tape resistors connected to this port at the back of the PET. And somebody sat down and wrote a program that would generate music. All you had to do was hook up that output to an amplifier, and you had music from the Commodore PET, even though that wasn't one of its supported capabilities. So people were coming up with some really brilliant things to do with very limited hardware. And it was fun in those days. I think to be at the beginning of it all, to have everything never done before, you could sit down and think of something and go, pretty sure nobody's done this before, at least not on a home computer. And you were probably right. And so everybody was always fascinated with anything you could come up with. I tended to sort of stick with just what I really liked, which I liked the whole idea of the word processor. I liked the idea of the text editor. And so maybe I should explain how that kind of became a commercial product. Back in those times when I was running around downtown, somebody told me about this computer store up in the north end, north of Finch on Yonge Street, called the Home Computer Center. And I checked that place out, and I showed off the text editor and the early text formatters to the guy that ran the place, and he said, I could probably sell these. And I made a kind of an agreement with him, he'd sell them for $25, and I got a certain cut of that. And so I made some changes he requested, and then I started crossing my fingers something would happen. Of course, nothing did. So I had a friend of mine go in there and pretend to be interested and just see what they do, and they pretty much just brushed him off. So I wasn't really happy with this guy. But fortunately for me, around that time, a guy by the name of Stuart Martin had been in the store, and he had actually seen a copy of the program. And he called me and said, there really is a market for this sort of thing. And he came over and we made a deal to start a company, which at the first was called Pro Micro Software. And we would sell this program. And at the time, it wasn't called WordPro. I called it a DCE text editor. I got the letters from Direct Cursor Editing, because most editors up to this point, if you worked with computers, were line number based concepts. Like you did for BASIC, line 10, type line 20. And if you wanted to change something, you list that line and type it in again or whatever. So I wanted to create an editor where you just went to the screen and changed whatever it is you wanted to change, and everything was presented as one block of text. So that's what I call the direct text editor. But it quickly became obvious that that was a really terrible commercial name. So Stuart came up, I believe it was Stuart, that came up with the idea of WordPro. So I washed my hands of that. I had nothing to do with making up the name. But anyway, so we originally released a thing called WordPro 1, which was kind of for just for the PET, and only worked on the tape. So it was fairly simple. It was for the low-end machines. But as time went on, Commodore came out with bigger PETs with more memory, more capabilities. They started coming out with peripherals like the floppy drives, like printers. There were companies making interfaces for the Commodore machines. There was one company that made an interface to allow it to work with a Centronics parallel interface, which most printers used at the time. And so now it became possible to hook PETs up to a wide variety of equipment, not just the things that Commodore sold. And so we expanded WordPro to take advantage of the expanding memory that was available in the machines. even though, again, even 64K, which was mind-bogglingly a lot compared to 8, is nothing today, you could at least do a fair amount of it. You know, WordPro continued to be written in machine language for the same reasons it was in the first place, and pretty much anything I wrote that was of any commercial interest was written in machine language because writing in BASIC just wasn't good enough. I mean, it was nice to have BASIC, and it would allow beginners to sit down and type 4x equals 1 to 10 print x, next x, and then you can go, cool, what I can do? And then, you know, numbers would jump up your screen. But for anything serious, you really couldn't use BASIC. And it wasn't until somebody actually made a BASIC compiler, and that was much further down the road, that using BASIC for anything serious was even considered. Even for the Commodore 64, any games you bought, anything serious, was inevitably written in machine language because BASIC was just really kind of like a little batch processing language to make it easy for people to write simple stuff. But serious stuff had to be done at the machine level because there you literally weren't limited by whatever BASIC said you could do. You could do anything the processor was capable of doing. So anyway, I don't want to bore everybody too much here. Anybody have any questions or any direction you want me to go in here?
I have a cassette at home which has WordPro on it. Doesn't have any numbers after it. And it's got a Commodore part number.
I know Commodore did sell them, sell WordPro for a while. I think that was WordPro 1. I wish I knew for sure, but I don't.
was that an arrangement with yourself or through?
From Micro. I never sold any myself. Like I say, the only deal I had prior to Stuart Martin was with the Home Computer Center, and they sold three of them. One, unfortunately, to Stuart. So that was at least they sold it to the right guy. And as much as my parents kind of thought that Stuart was trying to get the better of me, I said, look, you know, I made a lot of money off of WordPro, and even if he did rip me off of something, which I really still do not think he did, I still made a boatload of money I wouldn't have made otherwise, so I'm happy with how it turned out as far as the marketing goes. Even if I wasn't getting the best of hit. I hear about people these days, you know, they make millions upon millions of dollars on something, and then they turn around and try to sue someone for more because they felt they were ripped off. You know, I'm thinking, are you just greedy or you just like to make a point? Because if I made $1 million on something, I'd just go retire. The hell was going on? Any other questions?
I guess you didn't make $1 million off WordPro
then. No. I still made a fair bit, but I doubt it was $1 million. And you can imagine how fast you go through that. Any other questions about the early Commodore games? As I say, I was there.
Just a comment. You mentioned Stuart Martin. I can't remember how many years ago now, but I bought a B computer.
Yeah.
Off of Stuart, which I guess he had left over when Commodore gave it all for some permanent work on.
Yeah, he's still around, I think. Last time I heard from him was a couple of years ago. For the last 10 years, he's been, I think, the mayor of Owen Sound, or at least a councilor up there. He was just bound to get into politics, even to the local level. So that's, I think, where he's at these days.
Well, that back then he was really in Mississauga.
Yes. Yeah. Down around Cochran and QEW.
Yeah.
Well, you know, do you remember the WordPro package that had the girl sitting in front of the C64 one? It was a really professionally done cover, you know, for WordPro 64. That was his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Who, funny enough, was friends with my sister, and she was friends with her even before I met Stuart. Which is kind of a strange connection that I didn't even realize at first. And he didn't either. Like when he first came over and we were first talking about all, he didn't know that my sister knew his daughter. So that was kind of weird too. Small world.
Are there any stories behind the advertisement for yourself and
Butterfield? Yeah. How many people have seen those ads with Jim Butterfield, Brad Templeton, and myself? Yeah. There's two of them actually. There's the football one and then there's the baseball one.
Everybody's seen them, whether they recognize them or not.
Yeah. That, I believe, was Stuart's idea as well. Because we were telling, of course, that Brad had written the... how did he write it?
How?
Jim Butterfield, funny enough, Jim Butterfield didn't really write anything. He wasn't much of a programmer. at least not on the Commodore machines, but he was behind something we were selling. But the whole idea of having it together with the sort of sports motif, I guess, was because people like sports and it's going to get their attention. I thought it was fun, actually. You know, I remember getting there made up in a stupid outfit. Like the baseball one was much easier, right? Because there was none of the stuff on the face and that, yeah. But, you know, putting on the stupid pads and the black under the eyes and stuff. And it was just fun. I mean, it was just for one day. It was less than a day shoot, right? And, they weren't standing behind that backdrop. It's just, you know, standing in a little photographer studio with a single color screen behind us, and they added us onto whatever backdrop that they made up. So I really had no idea how it was going to turn out. I was quite surprised they turned out quite well. I was really kind of happy with how I looked at both of them. Although I think I looked kind of mean in the football one. But in both cases, I wasn't wearing glasses, which I always wear, but it doesn't suit sports players, so I didn't wear them. Now, Brad, I don't know if anybody knows much about him. He's actually the chairman or president of the Electronic Foundation, something. They're a group in L.A. that strong supporters of open
Electronic
Frontiers, yeah. He's chairman of that. So he's still doing stuff. And for anybody who remembers his name, his father was Charles Templeton, well-known Toronto broadcaster and writer. I know a lot of younger people, they say the name and they go, who? Because, you know, he died quite a few years ago, and any sort of influence he had doesn't really extend much to anybody who's under, say, 40 years. So, but if anybody remembers, the way I met Brad was in 76, we both had CB radios, and somebody said, you know, this guy's father is Charles Templeton, so I got him on the air and challenged him, and I said, is that true? And that's how I met him. We were sort of friends on the air for a while, and then we sort of discovered our common interest in computers. And it was funny, we both went down the same day to one of the U of T tours, you know, back when we were in high school. And they had these APL terminals, which had demo accounts on them, so they could show them off to visiting students and that. Well, Brad was absolutely determined to find out what the password was. And because they all worked on selected typewriters as terminals, they got rid of the retyping the password by typing lots of other characters over the same top before you typed in the password so you couldn't read it. But somebody had pulled the paper out or it got jammed or something. And he found out the password was demo. So we used to go down there on the weekends and log on to the APL terminals using the demo account. They were replenished every month with $10 in each account. There was about 10 of them, so we had plenty of time. So we spent our time writing programs and databases on the U of T computer when we really shouldn't have been. So that's an introduction to APL, by the way. I always call APL a T. Is the language for people who like to program in hieroglyphics. Because really, that's what it looks like. A bunch of symbols and means things. Or even just a digital audio. Yeah.
It'll sound like the CBC in a whole broadcast.
Yeah.
You're a big old person.
Well, I tried to write it in BASIC originally. Like I said, I quickly discovered the limitations before I
really got finalized on BASIC.
They never saw the light of day in BASIC. They were experimental, and I immediately, before I ever really got very far at all, I realized the limitations of the garbage collection and the speed. It was very slow. I mean, you have to remember, BASIC in a Commodore machine is interpreting. Everybody know what that means? Like, who needs it explained? It's perfect. You know what interpreted versus compiled means? Probably everybody does. Anyway, it was interpreted, so it was very slow. And for that reason, plus the garbage collection, I immediately thought to myself, I cannot continue with this project in BASIC. So it was a failed experiment in BASIC. You know, machine learning was the only way to go.
Sure. One was just not BASIC, and then, okay, this is no good, and then redo.
That's right.
Machine, I just wanted to give her a complete
work. No, never really got much further than trying to get the basic input working, and I realized, this is terrible. You know, so it never really got off the ground in BASIC. Actually, for a little while, I almost thought of just quitting on it altogether. I figured, I guess this is the machine's not up to it, right? I didn't sort of immediately think of doing it in machine language. I'd heard about machine language, so I sort of had an idea what it was, but I'd never written in it before, and I really didn't know what it was all about. So I went searching for books on it, which at that time were very hard to come by, because there weren't a lot of books on that processor. I actually met the guy who designed the 6502, Chuck Kettle, when I was in California one year when Commodore were pushing WordPro in the early days, and I was at one of the shows in San Francisco. I apparently learned you do not say the word bug in front of customers. Yeah, I was taken aside and pulled off for that. Nobody told me. I'm being honest. I said, yes, we still have a few bugs. And he took me aside. Never say that. Anyway, but I met Chuck Kettle there. I have a picture of him around somewhere. I took him all the way there. He was kind of weird. He really was a geek. He looked like a geek, even in those days. And he didn't look that young either. Now, of course, I was younger then, so I'm not sure how old he was. But he must have been in his late 40s or maybe early 50s. And he looked like an ex-hippie. And he dressed like one at the show, too. But he's exactly the kind of person you just thought would sit around and design a process. Because that must have been tough. But certainly finding information about the 6502 was tough in the early days. So I found what I could. I mean, there's no internet. You didn't just get on and type 6502, right? And immediately up pops all these web pages where you've learned. I had to go out and try and find the books. And back in those days, there weren't computer bookstores in Mississauga. That was one of those things we kind of had to go downtown for. And so I would go downtown and look around at the stores that sold books on computers. And I did finally find a fairly good one on 6502, and I brought it home and I read it all, and I learned how to work with it. Now, I already had the machine language monitor, so I knew how to enter the stuff. But once I started experimenting with it, I thought, hey, this really works. So that's when I thought, hey, let's revive the whole text editing idea. And let's see if we'll make a go of it, machine learning, and see what happens.
And you did the whole thing in the morning.
Yeah. The first version. I told you, I actually wrote it, I wrote hand-assembled an assembler for myself, because there was no assembler. Now, Commodore eventually came out with one about a year later, the proper assembler, so I did dump mine and started using that one, because it was done properly. It was a professional effort. And it wasn't, like, mine was cobbled together to suit my needs. Just barely. So, I hand assembled one, then I used it to assemble a better one. And so I worked up a couple of levels until I got one that worked really well. And then most of the early WordPros were written using that assembler, but after that I used the Commodore assembler. Any other questions?
So, what are you doing now?
Well, what was the concept protocol? Oh, yeah,
I was talking
about
that. I assume
that was part two.
That must have come after you did WordPro, or was that
something? Well, no, it wasn't until modems came along, really. Modems didn't really make an appearance in the public sphere until about the early 80s. So at least 3 years after Commodore came out with the tech. So plenty of time where modems were not a thing. First modems were acoustically coupled. You know what that means? You stick the phone on them. So it kind of required that you had one of those Bell Canada Northern Telecom phones that had that exact shape, because otherwise your phone wouldn't fit in those cups. Right? You had to have exactly the right type of phone, but everybody did. Mm-hmm. Now, the moment I sort of found out about modems, I came up with this other idea, which is, I didn't come up with the idea. I saw it somewhere else, and I thought, I'm going to do that. And that was bulletin boards. So I had one of the early acoustic ones. I can't remember who made it. It wasn't a Commodore modem, but it worked with Commodore because it was an IEEE device. Commodore PET used IEEE for the bus standard connecting to the drives and the other peripherals. So any modem that was IEEE compatible would work with Commodore. So that was one of the choices. Now this was at 300 baud. That's 300 bits per second. Can you realize how slow that is? I'll go home to our 6 to 8 megabit connection and compare that with 300 bits. Not megabit, not kilobit, bit. So, if a watch 300 baud filling in any character screen would be like this. Imagine this is the screen and my finger represents the characters appearing on the screen. That's 305. That's text. So it was small. But hey, you could transfer text from one computer to another somewhere else. This was cool. The most important idea was, first problem was, early acoustic modem didn't answer the phone on their own. So, you know, my background in electronics, I could at least cobble together something with a relay. So I designed a very simple circuit that would detect the phone ringing, and when it did, it would close the relay, and the relay would stay connected until it was disconnected by a signal from one of those parallel port outputs on the computer, one of the ones that could be used for somebody used for sound. I used one of the bits to turn on and off a little driver transistor, which would disconnect the relay.
So then auto-click,
right? Click. Yeah, well, the relay had clicking sounds. Anyway, so I built myself essentially an auto-answerer for the acoustic modem. And that was the first step to writing a bulletin board, because if the machine couldn't answer the phone for you, it really wasn't useful for anything. So once I got past that, I sat down and I actually did write this in BASIC, because it made more sense, and it wasn't really much of a speed limitation here, and the modems were slow as hell anyway. So I wrote something in BASIC, and I put my first bulletin board online on April 15th, 1981. And I called it WordPro EBS for no other reason than because WordPro was my big program, right? So that name actually stuck for a decade or more on my EBS for no particular reason. It's just what I called it. But anyway, one of the big problems with acoustically coupled modems wasn't the modem, it was the phone. These early phones, I don't know if any of you, those of you who are old enough know this, but if you're not old enough, you may not know this. The microphones in early telephones were carbon microphones. And the way these work is they have loosely packed granules of carbon inside them, and as sound struck them, it would cause the bits of carbon to compact a little more and then uncompact, and this would change a current passing through the carbon. And this is how the microphones work. Now, the microphone is sitting there constantly exposed to a tone of exactly the same frequency. This begins to permanently compact the carbon. So over a period of about a month, the carbon became compacted to the point where the microphone didn't work very well anymore and didn't pick up enough of a signal. So you had to take the phone out every now and then and go, and this would free up the carbon and it would work fine for another month. So it's a little maintenance. Anyway, that's not the modem's fault, but this was the way we were doing it. That was the fault. But like I said, you know, as crude as that is, as slow as that is, it allowed people to talk from computer to computer, which nobody had been doing before. I mean, up until then, you're all at the Commodore PET, we work on our own little Commodore PET, we traded programs with each other on tape, and that's all. We couldn't talk to each other, we couldn't send messages to each other, you know. But the bulletin board allowed us to do that. Now, typically, a bulletin board would only allow one caller on at one time, obviously. First of all, you only have one phone line. Secondly, you only have one modem. And thirdly, the computer's not really fast enough to do more than that. So basically, you didn't want people to stay online too long because they paused the time. Nonetheless, people were fairly good. They came on, they tried to stay on for as long as possible. You may have imposed a limit to kick them off after, say, 15 minutes or something. And it finally gave people a place they could call with their computer and read messages from other people. Really kind of like, not really like chat, but kind of like a newsgroup idea. You know, as bulletin boards progressed, the early ones would have just one repository for messages, and everybody would just talk by putting messages into one place. But as myself and other people who were writing EBSs progressed with them, they started breaking them up, you know, so that there were different places for different interests, you know, so the messages weren't all jumbled together. But the other weird thing is, we were running these things off floppy drives. Okay, so there's kind of a limit to how much you could store at any given moment. It was limited by how much space you had on two floppies, or whatever number. In fact, some of the larger BBSs had literally up to, you know, piled up to here 40, 40s, or 80, 50 drives. you know, and had lots of drives running on the computer at once. Sadly, this was another problem with Commodore. Reliability was poor. You could be guaranteed that those drives will overheat. So, inevitably, any drive used for this purpose was propped open and had fans put in it. Because if you didn't put a fan in it, you didn't get a better airflow, it would die a heat death. They all did. And when I was running a PDF, I was fortunate, because of, you know, Stuart and because of my connection with Commodore, to be able to get my drives replaced whenever they stopped working. And that happened frequently. So it was tough to keep a board online, because it was hell on the computers. They weren't meant to be left on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They weren't designed for it. But a bulletin board had to do this. It had to stay on all the time. It was being used all, maybe not constantly, but certainly much, much more intensely than was ever intended by the designers. So, but sending messages, that was one thing. But people wanted to send programs too. And here's the problem with modems. Modems don't guarantee that what you put in at one end comes out the other. Now, for text, if you drop a character here and there, it's no big deal. But a program, you can't drop a single character because it won't work. Probably crash, it'll do something horrible. Every character must go from one end to the other, absolutely unscathed. But the modem didn't provide a way to guarantee that. This is where transfer protocols came in. The idea was that we needed a way to guarantee that when we would send a certain amount of data from one end to the other, and then the other end would check to see if the data was correct, and if it was, it would say, okay, that's fine, send me the next one. This is basically how protocol worked, a very crude early ones. Now, I did not invent transfer protocols. Certainly, at the home computer level, there was already in existence of one called X-Modem. The X-Modem, it was a crude protocol, but it did its job and did it well. But being the kind of programmer that I was, that is, I didn't write it, I don't have access to it, so I'm just going to write my own. I wrote my own. But X-Modem didn't really exist in the Commodore community. So when I wrote a protocol, transfer protocol, and put it on my board, all of a sudden it became the protocol that ended up in a heck of a lot of Commodore PETs and a lot of Commodore 64s, and kind of became a sort of standard without me really even intending it to be. I never wrote it with that in mind. All I wanted to do was give people who called my board a way to be able to transfer programs to and from it. Of course, in those days, you couldn't just turn on your computer and connect to a bulletin board. You had to have a terminal program that you loaded in, because the computer didn't know how to communicate over a modem on its own. The terminal program's job was to know how to communicate with a modem and how to display the characters coming in on the screen and how to take the stuff you type and send it over the connection to the other machine. So the terminal program is where the transfer protocol would have been built in. In other words, you could have had a terminal program that did nothing but type and receive, but then all you could do with that is the characters. If you wanted to transfer program, then you had to have a terminal program with some form of transfer protocol built into it, and it had to match the transfer protocol used by the bulletin board system you were calling. Now, like I said, the early ones were quite simple. They were based on the concept that if you took a small chunk of data, now, by small, I mean about 256 characters. Now, that sounds like, you know, well, that's not very much. But remember, we're talking about 300 bits per second. That's approximately 30 characters per second. It still took the better part of 10 seconds to send 256 bytes of the program. So it was a fairly big chunk of data. And certainly, with line noise and other problems, something could go wrong during those 10 seconds. Now, what you did then was you created a checksum, some mathematical way of adding up and compiling the bytes that are in the block, and sending them along with it. Now, when the block of data gets to the other end, that end recalculates that same checksum and compares it with the one that came with the block. If they differ in any way, that means probably something went wrong. So the receiving computer sends back a signal to the transmitting computer and says, I didn't get that block properly. So the transmitting computer says, sure, fine, here it is again. And they keep doing this until it got it right. And then when finally the receiving computer said, oh, yeah, this seems fine, it sends a signal back to the transmitter, says, I got that, you can go on to the next one. And this is how transfer protocols work. Now, this is the simple way, and this is what my original transfer protocol was, one of these simple block checksum affairs. I didn't call it, just out of curiosity, I didn't call it Punter Protocol. For whatever reason, I called it C-Word. I don't know, it's like a development name and stuff. I wanted it to be known as C1, but I guess everybody thought that was a really bad name, and since I wrote it, I guess they figured Punter Protocol was as good as anything, and that's apparently how it got called that. So I actually did not name it after myself. I really did want it to be called C1, and I always referred to it as such if I was ever talking about it. But the problem with simple transfer protocols is they don't work well over long-distance connections, especially if said long-distance connection goes to the satellite. And if you called Australia, for example, chances are pretty good it went to a satellite. Why is that important? Geosynchronous satellites orbit at about 22,500 miles above the Earth. But you're going, yeah, but radio waves travel at the speed of light, which is really, really fast. But you talk about a 50,000-mile trip to the satellite and back. And then, to get a response back, it's got to do another 50,000-mile trip. That's 100,000 miles that the signal has to travel at the speed of light. Well, surprise, it takes about a quarter second to do that. And so as modem speed started to get faster, and the little blocks we were sending started to get there faster and faster, the amount of time it took for the signal to get from one end to the other, and the amount of time it took for the acknowledgement of that block to get from that end all the way back to the beginning, started to amount to a fairly large chunk of the actual transfer time. Like, if it took half a second to transmit the block, and half a second in delay for the response to come back, your protocol is now 50% efficient. And it got worse as speed increased. So, how do you deal with that? That's where newer protocols came along, and I did write one that I wrote specifically for allowing my bulletin board nodes to communicate with one another, but the one that really took off was one called Z-Modem. And these are called streaming protocols, and they address this problem by saying, okay, we're not going to require that the receiving computer tells the transmitting computer that everything's okay before it goes on. Instead, we're just going to keep chucking stuff out at the receiving computer, and if it gets one of the blocks bad, it's going to send us back a signal, and we're eventually going to get that. And how Z-Modem worked was, it would go packet, 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 packet. At some point, one of those packets wasn't going to make it to the other end intact. And the receiving computer would send back a signal going, packet number 62 is no good. And when that finally gets back to the transmitting computer, it could have already been up to packet 75 by then, right? But it goes, uh-oh, there was a problem at 62. We're going to rewind and start sending from there. But the point is that if everything went well, that is, if there was no problem with any bad blocks, there was never any delay. Because it was always just chucking them out as fast as it could go, and despite how long it took to get there, it would get there in one solid stream of data at full speed. It only slowed down if anything went wrong. Now, my C2 protocol, which, as I say, never really got beyond being an internally used protocol in my PPS, tried to address what I felt was a limitation of Z-Modem, which was that it retransmitted stuff it didn't have to. Because, like I said, let's say that the delays are so bad that you're already like 5 or 6 blocks ahead of where the bad one comes in. For all you know, if 62 was bad, 63, 64, 65, 66 may have all been good, but Z-Modem didn't care. It would start rebroadcasting from 62 again all the way over. So I thought, why not let the receiver take note of what blocks are bad, and when everything's done, send back a list of what it didn't get. And then send all back to it. And then if it doesn't get me then, it can send me back a list of those. This was much more efficient. And it was probably, in that sense, it was a better protocol. But I wasn't in the business of marketing protocols, and I wasn't interested in marketing protocols. And because most tech users, or anybody who still used Commodore protocols as opposed to X-Modem, Z-Modem, were Commodore users who lived pretty much in the same country, it really wasn't an issue for these people. So my protocol never, that other protocol never took off. I still think it was, I still think I did a good job of implementing the idea, and conceptually I think it worked better than Zed Modem, but Zed Modem was used on pretty much every other operating system that was out there at the time, and it became the de facto standard for quite some time. I think, if you're not that young, you may have used Zed Modem to transfer files at some point. It became the de facto standard after a while. But in the early days, when we didn't care about transfer delays, because we didn't bother calling people in Australia, because it cost us a boatload of money to do that. Everybody remember long distance rate and those things?
Full price.
Yeah, full price, especially if you did it during the day. It could cost you, it could literally cost you $10 to send something to Australia.
Didn't you say in the DBS documentary that I think you went on the top and like, I don't know if you remember, but the phone companies were just raping.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they did.
Well, that's back when they had their monopolies. And they could pretty much charge whatever they wanted if they could get away with it. And as I think most people know, Bell Canada continued to go on charging those sorts of rates, even while competition charged a lot less. I mean, the arrogance of that company. Yeah, the arrogance of that company is mind-boggling. So. Well, the fact that people continued to pay it is what's mind-boggling. There was all these advertisements for the cheaper long distance, and people just stuck with Bell and paid huge sums of money. And, of course, it was Bell that for the longest time hung on to the whole idea of paying less at certain hours. You know, if you're a young person now, you wouldn't even understand what the hell time-based charges were all about. Like, why should I wait till after 8? You know, it didn't make sense now.
Some cell phone plans or whatever.
Yeah, some are like that, but for the most part, long distances.
Yeah, that's a formality now.
It is, really. But, back in those days, you used to have to wait till a certain time unless you wanted to pay almost twice as much. Now, when it came to running BBSs, BBSs eventually sort of spread out into network BBSs. Like, again, I wasn't the one who started this. This started long before I actually did anything about it. But the idea was, if you've got a BBS that people call up, you've got one over here, one over here, and one over here, why don't we have them share the information they have stored on them by having them call each other and share that information? That way, somebody signing on to the BBS here in Toronto can have a conversation with somebody who signs on to a BBS in Vancouver without them ever actually having to call Toronto or Vancouver to do it. And without having an internet. These bulletin board networks were kind of the closest thing to the internet you could get at the time. The internet, I'm sure you were aware, has actually existed since the 60s, even before then. But it was really just for universities and the military. Public access was pretty much non-existent. So the only sorts of networks we had were these BBSs calling one another. Now, because they could do this in the middle of the night, they could take advantage of the cheaper long-distance rates. And they didn't have to do it during the day. However, this did mean that there was a certain, in most cases, 24-hour delay between when you posted a message meant for somebody somewhere else and when they would actually be able to pick it up. But nonetheless, you could still have chat or conversations with somebody who didn't live in the same city as you without spending money on long distance. So BBS networks, it's funny because this is where your name recognition gets all screwed up. One of the original networks of BBSs was called FIDO. Say that to anybody now, of course. That's my cell phone. And it was kind of weird when FIDO came along and I realized that I was actually talking about two different things that meant exactly the same, or it meant totally different things you said the same. And of course, FIDO as a network doesn't exist anymore, but it was one of the early network BBSs, and it was quite big. I forget how many systems were involved in it, but it was in the thousands and covered most of North America and other parts of the world. My little attempt at a network, which was called Pundernet, I guess it could use my name that time, was at most 80 nodes. But I had them across North America, a couple in Australia, so and one in Hawaii, so it was kind of fun.
By network, you just said, I'm not sure what you exactly mean. You just got a bunch of different.
Well, everybody ran their own BBSs.
But you're copying.
Those BBSs talked to each other.
Copies. Right. Everything's kept to date with the same data.
Well, yeah, whatever they wanted to support. Like what we had, what I wrote into the program was an idea of something called a conference, which would be similar to a news group, right? And just you know, the idea would be that a guy running a DBS would decide which ones of those conferences he was going to support. So if you supported all of them, it became quite an expensive phone bill to maintain all that. So he might decide he's just going to have this subset of the conferences on his board, unless his users bug him about it and want to have one of the others. So yeah, his computer would call up whoever served up that conference and exchange with that computer any messages posted in the conference by his users, and then it would download all of the new ones it collected from all the other systems up to that point. So yeah, it was really just a matter of duplicating data across multiple computers. It isn't like the internet, where literally everything comes from one computer. Like, when you get on the internet, it doesn't matter where in the world you go, if you sign on to a particular computer, you're actually signing on to that computer. The bulletin board network was a lot of reinvented wheels. Every one of those computers had copies of everything else the other computers had, so that you had local access to it.
How was the distributor of, I remember PlanetNet, using PlanetNet quite a bit, but you touched on distribution and synchronization. Was, you said whoever was serving the conference, so was there one?
Yeah, one particular node served the conference. He was the central point that you would pick him up from. But in order to make it easier on people, I also came up with this sort of kind of like call forwarding idea for the nodes. For example, there's five nodes in Toronto. And one of the guys, he doesn't mind spending the money to call up all these other nodes and pick up the messages. Well, I made it so that you could, with the permission of that node, if you were a Toronto node, you could call that guy and get his updates for conferences without having to call long distance. So it just saved some people some money by having one person make the long distance call and everybody else in the same area make local calls to him. So it's still, it was still duplicating everything on every machine, but it helped to control the cost by not forcing everyone to have to make their own independent long-distance calls to collect the data.
Almost an early peer-to-peer.
Yeah, kind of, but again, you know, peer-to-peer still doesn't copy everything.
Yeah. They do a lot of off-scratching too, though.
Yeah, that was the idea. You could take advantage of the way Bell Canada structures the calling areas. It's still bizarre to me, though. Here's an example of one. I have my sister-in-law lives in Georgetown. Now, Georgetown, even though it's actually a pretty much a butt to the top end of Mississauga, is long distance to Mississauga. But guess what's not long distance to Georgetown?
Scarborough.
I don't know what sense this makes. This is Bell and their weird way of thinking.
That's how we got the weird
idea. Yeah, that's
what's your call tonight. That was the whole.
Yeah, that was the idea. Like, there was, Jeff Goble actually ran a node in his home in Georgetown. But Georgetown was long distance for any Mississauga nodes, but it wasn't long distance for Toronto nodes. So, the Toronto nodes would call his to pick up his conferences, and he would dump his to the Toronto nodes, and then the Mississauga ones would call the Toronto ones and get them for free. So, nobody ended up paying long distance at all. It's similar to a trick you can do now with a cell phone if you've got one. Say, for example, you live in Mississauga, which I do. You make sure you get a cell phone number that's in Toronto, 416-647. And then if you want to call somebody, say you live in Mississauga, you need to call a landline number from your landline in Markham. And Markham is long distance to Mississauga. It's not long distance to Toronto. So, you forward your cell phone to the number in Markham, and then dial your cell phone number. It's a local call to your cell phone, and it's not long distance for your cell phone to forward to Markham.
Well, when Call 40 came out, Bell used to do that. Her friend lived in Pickering, wanted to call BBS's in Mississauga, couldn't get through that way.
So you set up a forwarded number.
Just forward my number, I would hear it ring once. You get transferred through, turn on 40, you got a
screen. I believe T-Pug used to do that, because my wife used to be responsible for running T-Pug's node on PlanetNet for years. Because it was in Mississauga, because that was an issue for long distance from places like Markham, they had a permanently forwarded phone number at the office in Toronto so that they could phone that and be local without having to pay the long distance fees to call Mississauga. So yeah, that trick's worked. Yeah.
Do you get any resistance from Bell Canada for doing that sort of thing?
Not officially.
And for the call forward?
Well, why don't they have their policies like your fixed number?
For all the bad things I said about Bell Canada, there was one situation where I cannot fault them. One time, I had, something went wrong with my connection to one of the nodes, and I called Tucson, Arizona, I know Tucson, Arizona, and the connection stayed connected for all night, 7.5 hours. I called up Bell Canada the next day, and I said to the girl, you know, it was just my computer, I didn't mean to, and she goes, oh, no problem, I'll just credit. I mean, you can't fault them for that.
How long ago was that?
That was early mid 80s.
I had a similar problem. I was on Image PBS on the 64.
Yeah.
And I used to call Mark Bay and share with him on the Image Networks. He went down for some reason, and without telling me. And my PBS called him every night for 2 weeks. And
he had an answering machine on it, really.
He didn't have an answering machine, he just said nothing.
No.
But I got billed 34 cents per call.
You know what that is? Mm-hmm. Normally they never charge for not unanswering calls.
And I went into a big fight with Bell over it, man. The 34 cents, something like 100 times every night for 2 weeks. It was a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's not like this little recent issue with Bell Canada, or Bell Mobility, with that person who stupidly let their kid run up. What is it? Hundred some odd $1,000 for it. Like, yeah.
Going back a little bit, you wrote PDF Pop original test.
Back when I wrote my first one in 1981, there was no Commodore 64 in the VIC. There was only the PET.
I didn't become aware of it until we talked about 80.
By then, I think I had PC versions as well. I didn't do PC versions until 87.
Yeah, I became aware through Jeff in 82.5, 83, and you were already networking. Well, you had it run on the PET, but I never used it on the PET. Were you networking?
I don't think I ever networked the PET. The first network versions were on the 64.
Okay, the other question was, what are the IEEE legacy? I mean, obviously, you started on the IEEE devices in the PET. Why do you insist on the IEEE? That was your big barrier to entry.
Well, the problem was that the only drives that were available for the Commodore 64 were those stupid 1541. They were very slow, much more unreliable than the unreliable 4040s and 8050s, and certainly didn't hold as much data as an 8050 or an 8250. 8250s held something where they 1.2 megabytes per floppy. Yeah. They had 2.4 megabytes on two drives. That was pretty good.
Limit your success by sending the entry point by 5240 blend by 9 after and
it was an issue. That's probably one of the reasons that I switched to the PC, really. That it had hard drives.
Yeah. I mean, you're so so vehement about it.
Well, because there really wasn't much in the way of there wasn't the 1581s yet. 1541s were slow, low-capacity drives that had reliability issues up the creek, If you tried to run a VDF on one of them, it was bound to fail, like at some point. I think that was part of my resistance, was the sheer low quality of the equipment that would have been used otherwise. And it was bad enough that the 64 didn't even work properly at 1200 baud. In fact, one of the issues with running a VDF at speeds higher than 1200 was, 2400 in particular, is that you had to change the timing coefficients in the machine to get it not to screw up at 2400 baud. And another thing that tended to happen with 64s is that the chip that was responsible for doing the serial communication would eventually go wonky, and you'd have to replace the machine. Well, yeah. Or if you could get the machine fixed, you'd fix it. But inevitably, it would do that. Another really stupid thing with my 64s, every one of them, is that if only I had a UPS, but we had a fan, in our bathroom, and when you turned it off, it created just enough of a spark. Mm-hmm. Every time we crashed the 64, it was locked right.
That's one thing we did to get the red compact UPS. So turn it back on to auto come up everything. This was wake up in the morning and be like, you know, like 15 voicemails on the stores. And the owner would scream,
VDS
is down.
I mean, it's hard to imagine how really unreliable the equipment was back in those days. You used to put up with stuff, if our computers crashed as often as those early ones did, we'd have thrown them away and buy something else. You just would not put up with it. I mean, reliability is incredible today.
Yeah.
compared to those days. You put a hard drive in a machine, well, if you're lucky, it'll run for 4 or 5 years without having a problem. The computer itself, okay, the operating system might crash, but it's not the computer's hardware that's usually at fault. You know, it's usually somebody else's fault that if the computer crashes. And as for, you know, jokes about Windows software crashing, Windows almost never crashes on its own accord. It usually crashes because some idiot didn't know how to write a driver. I mean, even Microsoft understood that you had to separate the user from the hardware. Thus, the whole idea of the hardware abstraction layer. But in order to write drivers to drive printers and USB ports and all the rest of it, they have to allow those people to write code that can walk all over everything. And inevitably, one of those idiots does, and you're running one of those drivers. And that's usually what brings down a Windows machine. I can't see how Apple's immune to that unless they have real tight control over every driver. Mind you, it must limit the drivers.
It does. That's what, yeah.
Well, that's what you're paying for, I guess.
Well, I remember in the DBS days, too, in Burlington and Oak Hill, we had two major camps, right? And then we had, like, the French Connection guys who did custom everything on TRS-80s, right?
Right.
Both French and Southern OTB board, right?
Yeah.
But everybody else, it was all the Atari camp and the 64 camp. And
there was no compatibility here.
No, I mean, yeah, the boards were all popular to call up and stuff, but there was always that debate over which was a better system to run a DBS on. And at that time, I don't think anybody would want.
Yeah, I don't think anybody
wanted
to watch.
Yeah, because I know Phil French, he ran, I have a video actually, my lecture is a little documentary in high school on the two DBSs on OTB and on TSC. And yeah, we had Model 2s and Model 3s, like five of them.
Yeah.
All custom shipped, and then you have 286 on the end. And that was what he ran, and the whole room would get under air conditioning and everything else.
The top of it's room.
Oh, yeah, it was huge.
Well, actually, the biggest bulletin board operation that I ever knew around here was two of them, actually. One of them was Canada, what is it called again? Canada Remote System. But one time, they actually operated out of a building very close to where I live. And the other one was Rose Media. They both ran the same software. Yeah. They had about 100 nodes on that system. Same as CRS. They ran the same software.
Yeah. And Brad, a guy I worked with, we were doing WN at the time because we bought up the CRS online.
Yeah.
And he was running that. He also ran Abacus too at home, and that was 8 months as well. But as soon as he saw the internet, he shut it down like within a month.
Well, I've had high speed internet for 9 years now. I mean, by the moment I found the internet, it was like I kept my DBS running for a little while, but after a while I started using that phone line for my internet connection, so that was that.
When did you shut it down, or how long did your BBS run?
My BBS ran officially from 1981, okay, April 15th, 1981, to, I don't remember the exact date, but it was approximately 97 or 98. It was a long time. It ran for a long time. But in the last years, you know, it was really one of those things. I kept it running because there was a few people who were still interested, but as interest tapered off, my interest tapered off, and I just stopped doing anything with it. Yeah, if it weren't for idiots like Roman Walston.
I remember that name, huh?
Yeah. I know he's still around. Yeah.
16 years is a long time.
It is, and I can't believe I actually ran it for that long, and over a lot of different machines, too, because in the end, it was running on a PC. Actually, it was running on a PC from 87 onward. So the sort of the Commodore days of my DBS were 1981 to 1987, 88 that range.
You keep it, how many nodes?
I don't remember the exact number. It was a 70 or 80 actual operating nodes at any one time.
And about a third of them in DBA.
A fair number of them were in Ontario.
I always wondered if you put the nodes of
I know, mostly Ontario. Well, again, that's that whole sort of Ontario-centric thing. And then we were talking about that. Toronto's fascination with computers seems to exist to the two today. I'm sure a lot of you may have heard, up until just recently, Toronto was, per capita, the most represented city on Facebook. London overtook us just recently, London, England. But I think that it's estimated that 20% of the Canadian population is on Facebook, which is far ahead of the U.S., which is like 5%.
The city was just a lot of cheap people.
Yeah, probably. I don't know why it is, but... I don't believe so. It wasn't YPK compatible, you know what I mean? Yeah, actually, the funny thing about my first test, the one that was bought from Commodore originally, way back in the mid-80s, I sold it to a friend of mine, but he kept it, and a few years back, he was moving, and he wanted to get rid of a bunch of junk, and he goes, "You want the computer back?" So he's like, "What, you still have it?" So I actually do have my original Commodore PET, just a keyboard with the tape, and I believe it still works. I also... actually, for some reason, I didn't wear it. I was one of the people that built a external keyboard for it. But I also have an old 40-column PET. The reason I still have it was I had intended to sell it at that swap meet in 1995, you know, right here. But a lawyer had called me and said that he was doing some cases and he wanted it, and I said, "Sure, I'll keep it for you." But he never came for it, never got it from me, so it kind of hung around in the basement too. It worked 12 years ago. We tested it, but it's just sitting down there. But other than that, no, I had a 128 sitting around somewhere, but I'm not sure.
Do you mind if there's an EDS archive?
You want to see if you can make it run. When I say it's not IPK compatible, what I mean is it was a two character date. I mean, now we're far enough away from 2000, it probably worked just fine. You know, it's not an issue now. But if you tried to run it between 99 and 2000, it would have screwed up because of the way it sorted the dates and everything. Because everything was stored as just a two-digit date number. So, in that respect, no, I wasn't. I knew that I couldn't run it anywhere past 99, so I had no intention of spending the time it would have taken to fix it. So, but I shut it down before then. But had it actually lasted till then, I would have shut it down after 99. Because it just wouldn't be worth the trouble fixing it to get through that period.
That was a compiled basic version.
Yes, it was. Well, yeah, there was a compiled basic version on the 64. You know, it used to take, and this is the part that really gets me, it used to take an hour and a half to compile it. And that I managed to cut that time down by running a Commodore 128 to 64 mode, because it still ran at 2 megahertz in that mode. So it was twice as fast the 64 as the 64 was. So I was able to compile it in about half the time. But that was still 45 minutes to compile it. That's a long, long time to get your compiled program up and running. Yeah, that's right. Then you find a bug, and you gotta fix the bug, and it's 45 minutes of compiling again. Because you can't run it in interpretive mode anymore, so you have to compile it. That was very time-consuming.
Well, you can have it in your car, that you wait 24 hours for
your compile. Well, yeah.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Yeah.
Oh, you would appreciate it.
Oh,
there you go.
Yeah.
Well, where I was going with this, by the way, is that a couple of us anyway, we and a few other members wanted to be talented together, and I ever proposed the idea to Grand Christmas for all day kind of silly talking. And I said, you know, we can put the T-Pub BBS back up, and we can put it up to talent BBS. I thought, well, we should contact Bill BBS if you, you know, she still have the old method basis, whatever, so you can get playing around.
No, but the problem was they were all on floppy, and you know what the reliability of the floppy was.
Actually, you don't mind, go ahead and put it back up.
No? Did they actually survive them?
Because they were so slow, they wrote very slowly, and the image lasts. Like, all the Atari discs, my friends just all died years ago.
Really?
All the Commodore ones that had sat in my friend's basement for over
they survived.
Years.
They could be read.
All fine.
Yeah.
Because the writing was so slow, it actually, actually harder than the magnetic stuff. It actually needed.
If you want just garbage and surprised, I went through a stash of the other 2 weeks ago. I was really surprised that
happened. A friend of mine that wanted to bump my computer, we once took a big magnet off a speaker and tried to erase one by going like this, right on the surface, it's still reading.
Mm-hmm.
So they're actually, they were hard to erase.
I think that the fact that the drive speed was slower actually came to the benefit. It's the same issue that I run into now with CDs, when you're burning CDs, when you're doing audio music or restoring stuff, we find that the higher speeds tend to fade after a couple of years because it just for some reason you can't hold it. But you do a
so if you
burn,
do a really slow burn,
slow burn, it actually retains it. And I'm wondering if it's the same principle behind the magnetic.
It could be. I mean, the problem, of course, with them is they were run on BBS is that the disc literally wore out.
Oh yeah.
Because the heads contact the disc, not like a hard drive. So they literally wear the disc away over time. Not to mention that the head get
coated
in that the powder that they literally wipe off those discs. This was one of the maintenance nightmares of keeping a BBS up and running. You had to clean the heads, you had to swap, change the discs, that means you had to copy new ones,
yeah.
You know, to take the place of your old ones. And, you know, these were all the things you had to do on a regular basis to keep the thing up and running.
Yes.
You know, it was a lot of work.
You know, it is. Just puts in a lot of
changes.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Once you got hard drives, and relatively reliable equipment, you can just turn it on and then just forget about it. There's no maintenance, really, except the occasional crash.
Hit the C64.
No, I'm surprised it stayed running there.
I think it's the best car supply.
You do have it under UPS.
Yeah.
Okay, that probably helps, because it filters the power, too.
Pretty much what I learned.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty well in Vegas, but UPS is quite mandatory.
You know, because the teeniest little power fail, even something with a light barely flickering, the computer still reads it. Those things were really sensitive.
They're going to take a couple of power, I think 64s, the old TV set up kind of power right up against it. Like, and then the TV set off the 7th and the 2, invariably. Just turning off the TV, if you do it in the right scenario, off CIA.
Yeah. Those 1701 monitors, I already mentioned, 1701, 1702s, those were good monitors.
They were great.
They were
great.
And they were JVC, actually. No, I thought they were JVC.
JVCs?
Yeah. Yeah. JVC was at least as good as Sony when it came to 52s.
Oh, yeah.
So, the 1902s weren't bad, but there was an issue with them. That they would go bad, but you would fix them if you knew what you were doing. But they were very, very good monitors. You know, for NTSC standard monitors, they were really clear, you know, for their time. But the 1701s and 1702s, I can't remember what the exact difference between those two were. But those things were really well built, even if they weren't really high render.
A lot of those don't use them. I mean, the biggest design feature is that they're stackable, they're square. You know,
mm-hmm.
So you see a lot of them used in security.
Yeah.
You can stack four of them like this.
And they just last and last.
Yeah.
You can rip off the labels on the back, too, right?
Yeah.
I bought one from a surplus store a couple of years ago. It gave me a warranty on it.
Really?
Yeah. It said, well, after 20 years, it lasted another 3 months.
Actually, for a little while I had a Commodore 64 running an old black and white TV because I was using it just for test based stuff, so I didn't waste a color monitor on it. But it looked okay on a black and white TV for text. But if you wanted to do any, like I had one of the early, I guess you could call them graphics tablets. Remember the Qualipad?
Mm-hmm.
You had one of those. They were fun, you know, given the limited graphics that 64 could do, but where else are you going to get graphics anyway? I mean, it used to be the graphics that you now take for granted on a PC. If you saw that on a computer, you'd be going, how many thousands of dollars did you pay for that? There were graphics terminals back in the 80s that looked surprisingly powerful for their time, but now would look commonplace today. So certainly, things that have sort of changed in the graphics department. Mm-hmm.
Your phone probably had a higher resolution.
Yeah, that's right. Probably a faster graphics processor, too.
more everything. Right?
Yeah, more RAM
storage. Your software said, you can copy in disk inventory, just roll that disk.
We
got your Geek software running in Vice, which is a Polymer emulator.
Right.
So,
Polymer on a PC.
So the fear about running on a PC, I think instead of doing it with these two, we're going to put an actual 64 and it's a whole rigmarole.
Right, so running on a PC.
Yeah, just going to roll it in a process and run the PDF, a little process that will just sit there. And it's funny, I can run as a joke and, just bring around it on this notebook, actually.
So the idea is the person just connects with their standard telnet.
There's actually a phone called CD terminal. You don't need it for your software capacity, but it simulates the common graphics. I spawned three emulators with three versions of your programming. We're trying to do message sharing, basically, it's re-simulating the punter net. Because three of them can talk to each other internally in the computers if there's three different. basically punter net over IP. Right? There's no reason.
The transfer protocol should be quite happy with that because everything should work fine.
Well, we actually got them on a single PC running MonoDB. Because I could probably run 80 nodes for PDF.
Because it doesn't use up a lot of processor time. Let me know if you get a running system. That's what I'd like to do.
The way you can get a hold of Steve is through the website about your cell
phone. Yeah, my cell phone webpage. How many people visited that? www.arcs.com/space. Yeah, I put that up originally 10 years ago because I'd been mapping the location of the cell sites in Toronto. I was doing it just for fun. And a few people had said, ooh, could you make me copy your map from me? Well, it's kind of a lot of work. But I thought, hey, there's an idea. Let's put up a web page and let's stick them there. So that's the sole reason I put the web page up in the first place, was to put the maps online. That was the primary purpose. Of course, not every visitor really cared one way or another, but of course, cell sites were located, so I branched out into other things. That's how I ended up testing phones. I started testing because I wanted to know what the hell I should get. So I thought, I'll test them. And so, but when I started testing them, I thought, what the hell, let's write a review and stick it online and, see if people like that. Apparently they do. That's one of the reasons most people visit it. Even though I only have a small percentage of them.
Why would anybody want to know what the size of the cell node is?
What cell site location? Not so much these days because the networks are quite mature. But back when they were just starting out, you want to complain about dead spots. There literally were places in Toronto where it didn't work. And they weren't very well covered the way they are now. And so where the sites were located was useful to know because you could sort of figure out where the coverage would be good and where it wouldn't. And it sort of played in with my original fascination with radio. Like, I even, back in 81 when I put up the VBS, I was even actually going to the trouble of trying to get a ham license, but I kind of gave up on the code stuff, so I never did. But I had an interest in radio and RF and so forth, and cell phones, while they were sort of removed me from the equation a lot, compared to playing with throwing transmitter or receiver, there were certain aspects about it that sort of played to my interest in radio. And where the sites were located, for some reason, seemed very interesting. Part of the fun was going out and actually finding them and figuring out how to find them. Now, these days, I don't have to because now all the cell phone companies have the list on Industry Canada on the web, so I can find them all that way. And it was funny, back when I used to go looking for them, I'm like, hey, this is fun, but I wish I knew where they actually were. This was a perfect example of careful what you wish for. Because I got my wish, and now it's no fun to go look for them anymore.
It's pure hackerism, man. I mean, it's liminal, and you're not really sure what's going on. I attract a certain kind of curiosity. You want
to... When it's hard to do, it's fun to do. When it's easy to do, it's not fun. Right. So there's no point, really. I mean, I still maintain the maps, kind of. I really don't keep them up as well as I should. But I could easily update them by just going to Industry Canada. I even wrote a program that takes the XML files generated by that web page and then converts it into data that I can use. Sorts them in nice order for me, so I can all the information I need to know. And I can easily transfer the coordinates at longitude and latitude onto the maps. So it's easy to find them if they're in data formats. and they're guaranteed to be right. But back when there wasn't that source of information, the only way I could find it with a site, you couldn't call them up and say, where are your site? They go, screw up. It's a security issue, we can't tell you. I actually had one person from Cantel, back when they were called Cantel, or Rogers changed me, who said to me, I can't tell you where they are because terrorists might take out our sites. And I'm going, you know, terrorists won't take out your site, knows exactly where they are. You know, and it's funny, back when the old Terminal 1 still existed, Rogers had a site on the garage, parking garage, and the antennas were hung off the side of the parking garage about level 7, and the equipment shelter was up on the top floor, and they had a barbed wire fence around it, and a warning on it says, warning, high voltage, which of course was BS. that wasn't really the issue. They just wanted you to get the hell out of it. Terminal 1, the old airport terminal
yeah.
Before they tore it down and put in the new terminal. Yeah. Remember that parking garage with the round?
Yeah,
it did. But they had a site up on that. And this is before the I don't know if you've heard about this, the big disagreement between the cell phone providers and the guy who ran the GTAA. He decided he wanted to up the rates a lot and dictate to them where they put the repeaters and how much they had in there. And they all said, go screw yourself. So they all pulled their repeaters out of the airport and all built sites right around the airport and beamed into the airport. Coverage isn't as good as it could be if they had repeaters in there, but they've done a good job of overcoming that. Plus, they didn't have to kowtow to this guy. He actually called me once. The guy who ran the GTA to talk to me about that because he knew I maintained the web page, and I asked him about why he was doing that. He was quite, he was quite polite about it, but he was quite staunch on the idea that he wanted to make more money off it. And that's pretty much it. And they showed him more poor by taking all his money away.
Well, I assume he did, because I was up there once, and you got an announcement saying that, you know this call is going to cost us $2 a minute or something. That was a while ago. There's other people, he's going to make a call.
I don't know what that was. Yeah, but nowadays they all have, like for instance, Rogers, which was originally a Fido site, at Terminal 3 has a site right on the hotel. The GTAA don't own the hotel. So they can't dictate to
the
Sheridan. They don't own the Sheridan, so they can't dictate what the Sheridan puts on it.
It's right
at the airport. Yeah, so as far as Terminal 3 goes, you find the Rogers in there. As for the new Terminal 1, it's a little distant, but it's got so much glass that I found that the coverage on most networks is pretty good. Virtually everywhere except the most deepest little corridors or something. But any of the public spaces inside the airport, even the lower levels, seem to work okay. It would be better if there were repeaters in there, but they're not going to pay the highway robbery that the GTA wants to charge them for. So they went to the expense of building the sites around the airport. There's a lot of them just really there for the sole purpose of getting a good signal into the airport property without having to pay them. I'm sure they're actually paying more for putting up those sites around the airport, they would ever have to pay to the GTA, but they all decided that he was being greedy and they wanted to show him up for it.
He was trying to get in their lead.
Yeah. They didn't like that. So that's what happened there. But my interest in cell phones is it's been around since about 1988, when I my first one. And it was not that huge. It was about a cell phone, it was about this big, but it was a Radio Shack model, which interestingly enough I found out later was built by Nokia. So my first cell phone was a Nokia, even though I didn't know it. It was a Radio Shack TT-100, is their in-car phone. Got it for the very reasonable price of $780 at the time. That was cheap. I don't know if you remember, but when Motorola first came out with the first flip phone, which, by the way, was huge. They held it as chunky and big. They wanted $5,000 for flip phones. So not a lot of people bought them. Because that's a lot of money. You have to be pretty rich. Funny thing is, cell phones and me seem to intersect on a lot of similar interests. One of the reasons I like running around looking for sites is I did and still do a lot of cycling. And the one thing you can do is combine those two interests. Because if you're out cycling, there's nothing better than having a targeted sort of route, something to look for while you're out. So if I would go somewhere and I'd say, okay, I got to find these cell sites, that would be what I would do while I was riding. So, it, and riding is certainly better than trying to do it from a car, let me tell you, because it's really easy not to be paying attention to the road when you're going to set. And walking, of course, is just way too slow because you can't get anywhere. Cycling is just right. You can get places fairly quickly. You can easily pull over and be out of the way of everyone and look at your heart's content for what you're looking for. It was the perfect combination of hobbies. You know, looking for the sights and cycling went together like hand in glove. So that really, you know, those two things together sort of spurred on both the interests throughout that period. Like I said, I really kind of screwed myself when I found out that I could get them all off the internet because now I don't have any real reason to do that. I know where they all are, and it's very rare that I ever sort of stumble across one that I didn't know about. So I can't really combine the two anymore, but for a while I kept the two of them really worked well with each other. And as far as the webpage, like I said, it was done originally to put the maps, but eventually expanded into the cell phone reviews because I did that for myself, but I put the reviews online because I figured people would want to know. And I sort of took this attitude that I'm going to review the phones on the basis of something that nobody seems to review them on, how well they work. Because virtually nobody reviews a cell phone based on how well it technically does its job. They'll tell you how good the camera is, how great the keypad is, how cool you're going to look when you hold one. But they don't go into how good does it pick up signals, how good is the audio, how does it deal with background noise. The technical issues which, whether you think you care or not, eventually if they don't do it right, you're going to complain. So that was sort of my shtick for the reviews, was they were always centered on those issues. And I completely ignored everything else. I once said, if they built the ugliest phone ever made, but it would work better than any other phone, I would own it and I would use it. Because looks don't mean anything if the phone doesn't work well. You know, if I can get one that looked great and was the best phone ever built, hey, great. But if it was ugly, I'd still use it. Because it was the performance of the thing that mattered. So I geared the reviews to that attitude. And a lot of people said, you know, great, you know, you're the only one on here who seems to review them for that reason. Sadly, I can only review them as I get them, and I don't have an infinite amount of time to do this, so I don't review a heck of a lot. I mean, there are any one time, there are hundreds and hundreds of models out there being changed over every few months. To keep up with that is just impossible. But I go after whatever ones I think are the most likely to be interesting to me.
You probably know, is there any market overseas for the old
analog
cell phones?
No, there's no analog networks really running anywhere.
No?
Not even in Russia. So pretty much, yeah, the analog phones are once the final analog networks are shut down, they are literally bricks.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere. Then you can't even use them to call 911 anymore because there's no network to connect to.
Well, I just thought maybe there was still something.
Well, there is still some analog in Canada, but I'm pretty sure both Bell and Rogers are planning to get rid of it fairly soon.
Well, Rogers is one of them. The Sunset Cloud is actually February.
Yeah.
That's when they're officially supposed to discontinue the app server.
Yeah. So that's all gone.
Well, Rogers is still running that app?
No, yeah. Not even running TDMA anymore either. They're all GSM strictly.
Well,
switched
over last year.
GSM switchover started, about 4, 5, or 6 years ago.
Long before they cut the.
Oh, and they cut the analog. Yeah. You know, there was also, you know, funny in the early days with my cell phone interest, there was also kind of a computer connection there as well. You know, the reason that cellular worked the way it did and was different from any sort of communication system we had before was because of the ability for you to put fairly powerful computers inside the phones.
Mm.
Because so much of how the network works depends on the phone being smart enough to be able to do some very fancy things. You know, the big deal being that if you're going to carry on a continuous conversation with changes from one tower to another as you move, then the phone has to have a lot of power in it to be able to communicate with the network and be able to know what to do as you move along through the system. And although the whole concept of cellular was actually visually envisioned and designed in the early 1970s, the computer power just didn't exist back then to build a cell phone, or at least at any reasonable price. I mean, we didn't even have the home computers then, much less something almost as powerful in a phone.
Well, we came around the same time, right? Around the same time as the
cell phones, actually, the first cell phone network wasn't built in Chicago until 1985. So technically, Commodore had it come out 7 years before that. And even the 64 was around by 85.
Yeah, I think I remember going to a couple of seminars around the early 80s.
They may have been talking about it, but the very first cellular network in North America was Chicago, and it came online in 85.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess it was talking, went to some seminars on technology and how it worked.
They were around radio calls.
Yeah, yeah. There was manual mobile telephones and a certain amount of automation where you dial the number. But the point was it communicated with just one power on one frequency all the time. So there wasn't really anything there that required any kind of computer power to deal with. It was standard radio with two things overlaid to make it possible to dial a number. But all the smarts was at the switch. All you had was essentially a dumb radio, a two-way radio that transmitted and received at the same time in full duplex, and could send pulses and whatever else to the switch in order to dial a number. Or if someone called you, then it would signal your phone to ring. But that was all. I mean, if you roamed out of range of the tower you were on, your call would disappear. But that didn't happen because they had the manual mobile telephone in Toronto was based on the CN tower, and the phones used 30 watts transmit at from the 150 megahertz, which is much better for long-range communication, lower frequency, but it's prone to interference.
I've got one. It's a nice contemporary handset with a digital display and a box like this.
It weighs 30 pounds.
How far back was that kind of phone you're talking about? The
very, very first manual mobile telephone, if I'm aware of, I believe, was put out in the United States in 1947.
Oh.
I think that was a mobile operator system. Actually, the Toronto system was, up until cellular was brought, it was all manual. You had to go through the mobile operator.
Yeah,
Bell ran it.
I don't always remember you could be disconnected from that big backpack everywhere you went.
That wasn't a manual mobile telephone, believe me. That one was, I told you, that one weighed 30 pounds and it didn't run off batteries.
So it didn't
you saw the aerial come first.
Yeah.
And then going on out of the keypad and this way.
Are you sure it wasn't an early cell phone?
For the box like
this. Yeah. It could have been an old, but then they were automated systems, and they did have devices where you punch keys. But that was just a matter of transmitting touch tones over the air to the switch, and really just giving you a wireless connection to what was essentially a landline phone.
Mm-hmm.
There was no real magic there. It's really a very powerful cordless phone.
Yeah,
that's really what it was. And it lets you transmit for 30-40 miles as long as you have a clear view of the CN tower.
I remember being called the tower phone.
Yeah,
that was it. Before cell phone.
That's because, before cell phones, they were. The only place you could use them was in a car.
Yeah.
I mean, there were, and to be fair, there were briefcase ones. Jeff Goebel had one, actually.
Yeah. It's just like laptop computers in the old days.
Yeah. Yeah. Desktop laptops. Portable computers. Pluggable, yeah, that's better. Oh, yeah, it was.
It was a rotary
phone, right? Yeah. Or even just manual mobile, where you picked it up, waited for the operator to say, and you told her what number you wanted.
Oh, yeah, sure. But
Yeah.
And that was in the 70s, I think you could do that in the
70s. Yes.
Smartphone.
Yeah. But it wasn't until 85, the first cellular network went up in Chicago. I don't believe Bell or Cantel actually started operations here until the 70s or 86, somewhere in there. So he only had the old manual mobile and phone. Now, actually, you'd think it would be really expensive, but actually the price wasn't that bad. When I had a manual mobile, although you had no free airtime or anything like that, it was 25 cents a minute. Now, as much as that's not cheap, it isn't over the top either.
Is this the backpack you
saw? What?
John was saying you had this backpack. The antenna.
No, actually, I believe what he might remember was, I had my CT-100, the in-car phone that I bought originally, so I wanted to make it transportable. Now, Radio Shack was selling this 12-volt rechargeable gel cell battery. It was about the same size as the radio itself, right? So I bought a camera bag, a stiff, you know, fairly stiff camera bag, right? And the radio and the battery would sit side by side, just use up the space in the bag. I then cut a hole in the top of the bag that was big enough to take a rubber and a rubber duct antenna that screwed into the antenna connector on the phone. And then in the sort of front pouch of the phone where you put your camera accessory, I put the handset, you know, the cord going into it. So I actually could carry that around. You know, and I carried that around for a couple of years. That's what Sean remembers. So, clients wanted to do some more hardware for me. Oh yeah, somebody asked, what am I doing now? And I guess that's a good sidetrack by a protocol thing. Yeah, I still program. I've tried to keep up actually with programming languages, and that's one of the reasons why I really don't have any personal interest in playing with PETs or 64s or anything like that anymore, because I kind of moved on as far as programming goes. The limit to what you can do with those old machines, and I like to do stuff that takes me in another direction. So I actually work a lot with Java and with C# or .NET. In fact, a couple of things I've been doing recently, I've been writing applications that work on cell phones. I actually have one that I'm sort of semi-seriously trying to market, but I got one guy who's going to sort of try to market it as a service in India. Which, what I wanted to do was I wanted to find a way to let people with cell phones more easily get access to visual information than they currently have. Like right now, you can get browsers on cell phones. I think most people who have phones with browsers know what I mean. You know, you can still browse the web pages and see anything you can see on your home computer on your cell phone. But it doesn't really centralize the information very well. For example, there's certain types of visual information that you might want to know while you're out and about. One of them being, for example, the highway cameras. Like, we all know that the ministry has these cameras watching the highway. You can look them on the internet, right? Okay, now, you can go on your cell phone and go to that web page and use their interface to try and find each of the cameras, but it's not a particularly convenient way to do it. And there's plenty of other types of information offered that are useful to the traveler or to people out on the road. For instance, another one related to traffic. The ministry has flow maps that tell you how well the traffic's moving on the 401, the various expressways, on the parkway. Great to know how the traffic is doing before you actually put yourself in. Again, but the problem with the maps is they're huge, and the information you want is still stripped down the middle. And again, you bring it up on the browser on your phone, and it's kind of hard to see because the browser tries to display it on your phone screen, and even if you can magnify it and move it around, it's still a pain to get to. So what I wanted to do was come up with a kind of a combination phone app and server application for a PC that would allow you to find all of these useful types of information you want and then present them on the phone as a simple menu choice. So I have one running on here. This is an iDEN phone. The data on iDEN is actually kind of slow. I don't really use the phone for data, but it's good enough to show them. Plus, it's free. In a second. I know it's going to be hard for you to sort of see this, but when I say about menus, I mean, it's just a simple menu. It's like a menu structure, but the way the menu structure is displayed, it depends on how you set up your little server at home. So, for example, if I want to go to highway cameras, I choose highway cameras, and then that brings me up a list of all the different highways I can select from. Let's say 401. And then from that, I get a list of all of the highway cameras that I can see. And one of the more interesting ones at night is usually Yonge Street. Yeah. Well, no, they usually, because they're doing so much work on that bridge there, that, I thought the data's a little slow on this thing. But anyway, if you have a high-speed phone, like one with high-speed data, you get this in almost no time at all. And there's not much to see, but there's that diary camera at Yonge. So it's fairly easy to find because it's all done in a nice list for you. And I have all sorts of other things I put on my server, the floor maps, I got weather the Environment Canada weather maps that show where, you know, it's raining and where it's not raining. You can put on, if there's any webcams you'd like to keep an eye on, you can do them too. So it's a combination of three different little applications. There's the one that runs on phones, written in Java, so it'll run on most phones that support Java. Surprisingly, that does not include BlackBerrys, which require it being converted into some weird format, which apparently doesn't work. But
so they're not a clear Java protocol.
Yeah, well, they are. It's written in stock Java API, but for some reason, it will not convert and work on a BlackBerry. A lot of people have tried. But I use the standard Java API that's supposed to work on J2ME devices.
So they probably customize. Yeah, they probably customize.
Probably. Yeah. Well, the thing about the SDK for programming phones is that the basic J2ME for Java for the Java 2 for micro editions, something like that. Anyway, is that there is only a certain number of APIs that are guaranteed to work on most phones, and they deal with sort of all the basic stuff, screen access, you know, graphics, that kind of thing. But if you want to do anything that's phone specific, then they usually come in phone-specific API, which means if you write a piece of Java code that uses a phone-specific API, that program only works on those phones. If you want to write something that will work on many different phones, a typical example of well-known Java apps that do would be the Google Maps application. How many here have Google Maps on their phone? If you don't, you probably surprised to know you can put it on for free. It may cost you to use it, but you can put the app on for free, because Google gives it away. There's also a Gmail application. I use that as well. It gives you access to your Gmail account. It synchronizes with whatever you've done on the web. So if you read a message on the Gmail app on the phone, it's marked as read the moment you look at it on the web.
Not the smartphones, right?
No, any phone that runs Java.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it doesn't have to be a smartphone. As long as it supports Java, J2ME or Java, and you should be able to run it, unless the provider has locked you out from being able to put the apps on. And so many of them do that. They're greedy. They want you to buy their stuff. But if you know how to put the app on your phone, some of them are easy. Nokia's in particular.
Is that what they refer to when they're talking here in North America about the unlocked phones? Are you allowed to do that? Or is that phone service?
No, when unlocked, yeah, unlock refers to phone service. If your phone is locked, what that means is that if it's a GSM phone where you put different SIM cards in it, if you try to put a SIM card from a different manufacturer into a locked, or a different provider into a locked phone, it will tell you can't do that. Like, say, for instance, you buy a phone from Rogers,
right?
And you try to put a Fido SIM in, which is funny because they own Fido.
Yeah.
But anyway, if you try to put a Fido SIM in a Rogers phone, it's not going to let you, and vice versa. And if you bought a phone from, let's say, the United States, say, on T-Mobile, or Singular, or AT&T, and you try to run a Rogers card in it, it's not going to work if the phone is locked. So what you can do is you can get the phone. Now, most GSM phones can be easily unlocked. Most places you can do it for you for relatively cheap. Once it's unlocked, it'll now accept SIM cards from any provider. And so you can now use that phone on Rogers or Fido or whatever you want. Now, when it comes to locking down other features of the phone, that's something else again. When cell phone companies sell phones, a lot of times they have the firmware customized for them. And a lot of times this means blocking out or locking down certain features so you can't get at them. And in some cases, for instance, Verizon was horrible for this in the States, is that you could not install any application on it that you didn't download from them and pay for. So you couldn't put your own custom apps on the phone. But pretty much any ones where you can, most people who know how, put things like Google Maps, Gmail, applications, like, and this thing called, if your phone isn't got a browser in it, this thing called Opera Mini.
Yeah.
Yeah, Opera Mini is a very popular Java application that can be used to surf the web on any phone that doesn't have a browser on it. So that's what those terms mean. So anyway, I've been writing some apps like that as well. And it's fun because although the phones are limited, kind of like early computers, the point is that they're amazingly powerful in a number of ways. For instance, pretty much any phone out of the box has TCP/IP and can connect to the internet. Now, it may cost you to do that on your service, depending on how your service is set up. But literally, then, you can write a program for a phone and be able to assume that it can connect to the internet. And thus allow you to do pretty much anything you want with that phone by connecting to a server somewhere on the internet. That's why I wrote my app as kind of a multi-part sort of process. There's the program that runs in the phone. There's a server that runs on a PC. It runs as a service, so you don't even see it. And then there's a front end that you can use to access the server, so you can modify the menus, change what it is you can see. And to extend it a bit further, I also wrote, you could write your own DLLs that extend the capability of the server by letting it paint images that couldn't otherwise get. For example, if you go to the Environment Canada webpage, you can get the weather, right? But to see that on a phone doesn't really work that well because it's not really tailored for a phone. And they may have a pared down site that works better. But what the DLL idea in my server allows you to do is to literally paint an image and send that to the phone. So you can scrape any information you want from a web page in text form, add it to images, pictures, whatever you want, and build an image and then send that. So in the case of the Industry Canada one, or the Industry Canada, Environment Canada, I take their logos for the different weather conditions, and I take this great deal of information like current temperature, humidity, things like that, and forecast for each day of the week. And I put all them together in a single painted image, although I was painting it directly to the screen of the phone. But instead, I'm creating a JPEG image, which is then transmitted to the phone. Now, another thing that my application lets you do that you can't do when you're going on the net is it lets you decide on levels of compression for the image. You could decide, for example, if you want to try and save money, like say it costs you a minute to transfer stuff, or like say if I did it's kind of slow, then you want to try and keep the size of the image small, say at the expense of a bit of quality. So you can set up from the user's phone what level of quality it uses to transmit the image to you. So if you want high quality image, you've got to have a big file. If you want a small file, you've got to select the lower quality image, but you can choose that. Each individual user of the server can choose the level of quality they want to suit how much they can spend or how fast their connection is. So that's the sort of thing I've been working on. Plus, the last decade, from about 94 through to about 2003, I worked at a company called Cesarotti Technology, and one of the things they wanted to do was, well, one of the things they were doing was data acquisition. Anybody's not quite sure what that is. That's basically where you take a bunch of sensors and put them on something like an engine and bring all the data into the computer and do something with it. Look at the engine speed, temperature, that kind of thing. They knew that there were some packages out there that would run on computers and let them do that. But they wanted to see if they could, develop something on their own that would do an better job. So what I ended up writing for them over that period of time was I wrote an entire language. It was kind of like Visual Basic. I wrote my own language interpreter, which is very much like BASIC. It was built in the Visual Basic style, where you literally dragged objects onto a form to create what you wanted. My objects were things like physical gauges, switches, buttons, knobs, that kind of thing. It would be typical for building a test rig or something. And then all you have to do to hook up a gauge to an input was literally you just, one of the properties of the gauge was what do you want to use as an input to this gauge, and to support multiple data acquisition cards, I also built the program to work with drivers, the same sort of concept used in computers where the software doesn't actually communicate directly with the driver or the hardware, the driver does that. And the program communicates with the driver. So if you have a new piece of hardware come along, I just write a new driver, and all of a sudden we're using that too. And they actually used this in a number of the jobs they did. They built an entire test rig for the TDC that tested alternators out of their buses. Those things are huge. And they wanted to be able to take those alternators, hook them up to this thing. And so part of their job was to build the physical part of the test rig, but they used the software as well and wrote a program in my development language, which did all of the testing and graphing and all the rest of it from data picked up from the hardware. So I spent quite a bit of my time doing that, almost as long as I spent on WordPress. So that was kind of a big process. You really started out as a, you know, I started out as a 6-month contract. But they liked what I was doing so much, and plus they were getting money from the government to have me develop it. So
that was
So I estimated that just in how much they paid me and how much they spent on support for people that had to help me, they probably spent $500,000. And they never sold it. It was only for their own internal use. So I don't know how much of that money they got from the government, but it must have been a lot.
Two things. First of all, we're supposed to go to the church by 10.
Okay.
To wrap up. And David Ivan says, look.
Oh, he's online there?
Well, he posted to Conscious CBM. I wish I could make it.
Well, he's one of my Facebook friends anyway.
Okay. It must be 15-ish years since I've seen Steve, right? So I know him for 15 of PCPN back in the day. So oh, hi.
Well, tell him I'll say hi to him on Facebook. I haven't talked to Ken in so long. Is he still around?
Yeah,
I'll see you on Facebook.
Probably.
Yeah. Anyway, anything else before I put it off?
Thank you very much.